Our guest this week is a multi-platform talk show host who's heard each day between 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. Eastern Time across the nation on the USA Radio Network and seen during the third hour of that show on Newsmax TV. He is, without doubt, one of the most ardent supporters of Donald Trump in the talk media today. He brings a powerful level of enthusiasm, energy, and articulate passion on behalf of Trump and the Republican Party to the national conversation. And during the past few years since entering the dynamic world of talk show hosting, his career as a personality in this branch of the media has skyrocketed. Of course, it would be a mistake to call this colorful character an overnight success. Born in the New York metropolitan area, Mount Vernon to be specific, in 1961, his political career goes back to 1964, when at 3 years of age, via his working-class parents who were pioneers of the New York State Conservative Party, he became involved in the presidential campaign of Barry Goldwater. At the age of 21, he ran as the Republican nominee for a county job in New Rochelle against an unbeatable Democratic incumbent, and although not winning, he narrowed the gap between the Republican and Democrat to a closer race than the 19 other consecutive times his opponent ran and won by landslides. He attended Columbia University, where he studied pre-law and political science. His first involvement with radio and TV was at WNBC New York in the 80s and Financial News Network on cable in the early 1990s. He then relocated to Las Vegas. He was founder and chairman of Winning Edge International Incorporated, and in the 2000s he hosted Winning Edge, a television show which promoted his sports handicapping operation. He also co-hosted King of Vegas on Spike TV and produced Ghost Adventures on the Travel Channel. In 2008, he was nominated by the National Libertarian Party to run for vice president on the ticket with its presidential candidate that year, Bob Barr. Stand by for a fascinating conversation with an emerging force in today's talk media. Our guest this week is Wayne Allen Root. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We'll dive right into a provocative conversation with the dynamic Wayne Allen Root. But first, a very quick programming reminder from Podcast One. You have to check out this amazing new true crime podcast. It's called 22 Hours, An American Nightmare. It's about a murder that took place in Washington, D.C. A family and their housekeeper were held hostage for 19 hours before being killed when the murderer set their mansion on fire. You'll be shocked by what they went through during those 19 hours, and you won't believe how they found the guy. I won't ruin the ending, but all I'll say is pizza crust. I'm telling you, it's awesome. Podcast One teamed up with award-winning journalists from news giant WTOP to put this story together, and the podcast is great. Download 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, now on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. New episodes every Monday. Okay, here we go. A conversation with USA Radio Network and Newsmax TV talk show host Wayne Allen Root. As I mentioned earlier, Root is one of the most dedicated and loyal supporters of Donald Trump in the media today. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of his background and philosophy, I'm going to play for you an excerpt of a conversation I had with Root on my National Week in Review program heard on Washington's Wonk FM a week ago to get his reaction to Robert Mueller's testimony before Congress. It clearly shows how loyal he is to the president and representative he is of the views held by Trump's 60 million plus voters. Keep in mind that I do not bring a prepackaged partisan ideology to my work as publisher of Talkers Magazine, nor to my on-air and online broadcasting projects. I subscribe to the philosophy that one should not seek victory if it is at the expense of truth. That being said, to explore the mind of Wayne Allyn Root, I asked him how he felt about Mueller's testimony while it was happening.
It's no secret, Michael, that I think it's a witch hunt. I don't think that's a big secret. The whole thing is a big joke. I think all of America at this point comes down to, if you're a conservative Republican, the media watches every word you say, listens to every Trump speech, listens to every Trump interview. Whatever they don't listen to gets leaked. And same thing they do to Wayne Root on the radio. I mean, right-wing watch listens to 3 hours a day of my radio show, and if I have one sentence out of context that they can destroy me with, they try and do it. But on the left side, nobody's listening, nobody's recording, nobody ever talks about the comments that people on the left make. It's a very one-sided way to approach, American politics. But it's gotcha, but it's only gotcha really for one side. You know, if Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib says something horrible, something anti-Semitic, something anti-Israel, the conservative media covers it, but the mainstream media says virtually nothing. And then when Trump responds to it, he's the worst guy in the world. So that all ties in with your question, because I don't even know what Mueller is doing there. He issued his report. The report says Trump isn't guilty. He'll claim it doesn't say he isn't guilty. It just says, I couldn't prove he was guilty. In America, that means you're innocent. In other words, you go to trial, and a district attorney can't even prove enough to bring you to trial. You're innocent. If you go to trial, you get found innocent. You're innocent. Either way, you're not guilty in America. Donald Trump is innocent. They're trying to make this last forever. The report should have been the end of it. There's no reason for the testimony. And the little testimony that I did see this morning, it was amazing to me. Robert Mueller looked like a completely confused, mumbling, bumbling, stuttering old man who's lost his ability to be coherent. So it's like he was caught off guard. He didn't even know he was going to be testifying today. He was completely unprepared, and he looked awful. So, I don't know what to say. There was no Russian collusion, and they couldn't prove obstruction of justice. And by the way, I don't even know why anyone is even talking about obstruction of justice, because every good lawyer in America who understands the law says the president can hire and fire anybody he wants in the whole world and doesn't have to ever justify why he fires them. So what obstruction of justice? The president could decide at any moment to fire the head of the FBI for any reason it's within his right to do so. So I think all of this is just a gigantic witch hunt being carried on by the Democratic Party, because they can't beat Trump any other way. He's a lock for re-election in 2020, at least electorally. He's a lock for a big victory, and they're desperate about it, and they're upset about it, and they've got Trump derangement syndrome, and they don't know how else to react but to lash out like little children. Obviously, everybody, Michael, has an opinion, and everybody has a bias, and if you tune into CNN and MSNBC, it's like a different world, and if you tune into Fox News or my channel, Newsmax TV, it's a different world. We all see things completely different, but in the end, it's just the most incredible thing in the world to me, almost like a late-night Saturday Night Live comic thing, is that all Democrats ever talk about is no man is above the law and Trump isn't above the law, but then their entire party is based on every illegal alien walking into the country is above the law. As a matter of fact, not only above the law, they want to decriminalize the crime and they want to give all of them free health insurance. Every second of every day, a sanctuary city protects murderers. They're all above the law, according to the Democratic Party. But the one person who isn't above the law is President Trump. I find the whole thing comical. I mean, every day, my rights are violated as my taxes go up, my property taxes, my sales taxes, my income taxes, because you're taking care of people that are illegally in the United States and giving them everything free and demanding everything for them that my kids can't get, because my kids have the bad luck of being legal American citizens born on American soil. And yet you're talking about the law when it relates to the president. As far as I'm concerned, there is no law anymore in this country.
So that was Wayne Allyn Root's tsunami of opinion in support of Donald Trump that he expressed to me when I interviewed him last week during the Mueller testimony for my radio show, The Michael Harrison Wrap, heard on Wonk FM in Washington, D.C., and several stations across the nation. It's an example of what he brings to his show each day on the USA Radio Network and Newsmax TV. It was at that point that I left the recorder on and continued the conversation for this podcast to get more insight into the man behind the position. All right, let's talk about how you got to this position. Listening to you is fascinating. You're full of passion. You burst with energy. You make a very compelling case for the support of Donald Trump. You're one of the most outspoken Trump supporters in talk radio today. And in the past few years, since you've become a serious radio talk show host, you have
enjoyed tremendous success in starting out in Las Vegas and going national. Now you're carried by a number of stations around the country. Talkers Magazine recently recognized you as being one of the 100 most important talk show hosts in America. Amazing accomplishment in a fast time. And you've done this recently in a life that has been long and colorful in a lot of different areas. You were originally in broadcasting back in the 80s and 90s, but in a very different capacity. How did you get into radio and into broadcasting, and what changed in your life to suddenly have you be this frontline in your face talk show host?
Well, you know, look, I don't think it's that difficult a formula, you know, to do well in either radio or TV. I think you've got to be a great talker, and you've got to say things that are in your face and that are interesting and that are unique. You know, you find unique angles in every single, topic out there, every single hot-button issue out there. And I think you've got to be a great salesman. You know, you're always – in anything you do in life, by the way, Michael, my theory in life is if you're a plumber, you better be the best salesman in the world. If you're a school teacher, you better be the best salesman in the world. If you're a policeman in all those professions, you're not supposed to sell, and yet you are selling, because plumbers who can't sell are out of business pretty quickly, and a teacher who can't sell, the idea to our students that, you know, they've got to learn education and grasp it and envelop their life in it, that's a pretty lousy teacher, and those kids are going to go on to a failed career if they don't have a teacher that gets them excited and motivated. And a policeman who isn't a good salesman won't know how to talk someone down from the roof or talk someone down from a hostage situation. So I'm a great believer that everyone in life has to be a great salesperson, a passionate salesperson. And I think the number one salesperson in America is Donald Trump. And that's how he, you know, went from a reality TV host to a businessman to reality TV host, a branding guy to president of the United States, despite never serving a day in office in as a dog catcher on the local level. I mean, it's an amazing story.
So has Donald Trump inspired your career?
Oh, my whole career is about Donald Trump. This section of it. I mean, here, first of all, I graduated Columbia University in 1983. I was at Columbia from 79 to 83. I'm an SOB, son of a butcher, right? And so at that time, if you go back and look at the newspapers in New York, the Daily News and the Post, all they ever talked about during my 4 years in college was this young, brash guy named Donald J. Trump, who was the son of Fred Trump, who was one of the biggest real estate owners in Brooklyn and Queens. And this guy was building this grand hotel around Grand Central Station in New York right about the time I was going to college, and he was in his early 30s or maybe late 20s at that point. And then right on the day I graduated college was, I think that was the week that Trump Tower opened, and it was all over the news, and the gossip columns had nothing but Trump, 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 Trump. So from a very young, formative age, this guy was my hero, as he was for almost every young guy of that age in New York City at that time. And so my life was built around Manhattan in New York, and I was, you know, in my early, late teens and early 20s when Trump became the star of New York. So he's always been, kind of a motivating factor for me. He's always been a hero of mine, a mentor of mine, or I should say I was a mentor for many young people, and he was a mentor to me. So it kind of goes around, you know, it's a cycle. And for me, it was Trump. And so for a long time now, I've studied Trump's life, but certainly since he decided to come down that escalator and run for president, he's the guy that has, really motivated my political, media career. There's no question about it. Everything about it has been a positive shoot in the right direction because of the fact that I called Trump right. I got it right from day one, and that's what built my career. I was the guy who wrote on the day Trump declared, which I think was June 15th or 16th, 2015. On that day, I wrote a column for Fox News that they published in the headlines that said, you're looking at the next president of the United States. I mean, he was at 1% in the polls. People thought he was a joke, a reality TV star, and I saw something that nobody else saw, and I continued to hit home runs with every article I wrote for Fox and other conservative media. You know, I said things no one else got. I said, at one point I wrote for Fox, you're looking at the first Hispanic president. And I wrote, no, I'm not joking. I'm kind of tongue-in-cheek. But the reality is, does it matter if all the Hispanics hate him right now and they all say he's a racist right now because he just gave the speech announcing for president and he said so many Mexicans are rapists and murderers and all of you hate him right now. But trust me, when he becomes president, you'll love him because he's going to create more Hispanic jobs than any president in history and there's going to be the lowest Hispanic unemployment rate in history. Well, I wrote that in 2015, Michael, and it turned out to be exactly right.
Oh, so you do believe that the Hispanic population is starting to like him?
Well, first of all, remember, he did better in the election, despite all the vitriol. He did better than either McCain or Romney by a large amount with Hispanic voters. And I think if you look at the approval rating now, most of the polls show 50% approval among Hispanic voters. So I predict he'll do very well. Is he ever going to get a majority? Probably not. But, you know, he got in the 30s, which was respectable last time, considering everything going on. It was amazing. And I think this time he'll get in the high 30s, low 40s, maybe even mid 40s, which is approaching what George W. Bush did. So, I think there's no question among legal Hispanics in the United States, they should have the same opinion as I do, that letting millions of new people in, Hispanic or otherwise, no matter if they're Hispanic, Asian, Russian, Indian, but primarily Central America and Mexico is what's coming across that border, and letting them in is bad for anyone who's got a real job and went to the trouble of becoming a legal American citizen. Even if you're Hispanic, you've got to be upset that all the Hispanics are coming over the border. Look, I'm Jewish, and I say all the time on my show, if America was being invaded by Israelis illegally, and they all wanted welfare, and they all wanted jobs that belonged to me and my relatives, and they kept my wages down, I'd be the first one to say, build the wall, secure the border, and send these Israelis home. I don't understand why it becomes racism, you know, because I'm Jewish or I'm white, and they're Hispanic or somebody's black. I don't care about the color of anyone's skin. I care about the law. And if an Israeli breaks the law or a Jewish American breaks the law, they should go to prison or be kicked out of the country, whatever the situation may entail, just as much as a black person or an Hispanic person or an Indian person or anybody else.
Okay.
The law is the law.
All right, taking this away from it being a discussion that people could hear on the radio that you do every day, let's talk about you a little bit more. I find your history fascinating. You had a political career going. I wonder, you don't talk about it much, and I wonder if it's just something you would rather forget or you've moved beyond it. But you were the nominee for vice president for the Libertarian Party back, when was that?
In 2008.
And that ain't chopped liver. I mean, that's a big deal.
Yeah, well, and, I'll educate you one-on-one before that, Michael. Uh-huh. In 1983, I graduated Columbia University, and 1 week later, the chairman of the New York State Conservative Party called up me, and he said, you know, you've been in politics your whole life, because my parents were two of the founders of the New York State Conservative Party. And he said, I've heard for 10 years now your father, my father was the butcher, David Root, telling me that his son was going to be United States Senator of New York, and that you've got to watch Wayne Root. And the minute he gets out of college, this kid's going places in Republican politics. And he said, I've heard this for 10 years. Let's go see if it's true. There's an opening for county legislature, and the person who's already in office is a Democrat that has never lost. She's 10-0 in 10 elections. She's in an unbeatable district. No Republican could ever beat her. As a matter of fact, in two elections in a row, nobody ran against her. And in the last one where someone had the guts to run against her, she beat him like 15,000 to 500 votes. It's an all-black and Jewish district, 100% Democrat, including major poverty-stricken projects in New Rochelle, New York, which no Republican has ever stepped foot in. Nobody wants to run. Do you want it? You're 21 years old. You got out of college a week ago. Want it? And I said, I'll take it.
Wow.
And I ran against her. Her name was Audrey Hochberg. And I didn't win, but I made it the closest race of her entire career before or since. She ran 10 times before me and 10 times after me. So she ran 20 times for office. And I was the closest race in her entire career. And I was a 21-year-old kid who had no idea what he was doing. You can go a long way with energy and passion. I went door-to-door to every house in the district, including every door in those black housing projects that no Republican had ever stepped foot in. All the black women in those projects who were mothers were so shocked when they answered the door, and there was this little young, you know, young-faced white man standing in front, white boy standing in front. I looked like I was probably 18, even though I was 21. And they were so shocked that they all loved it. And they said, what are you doing here? Your life's in danger. You could be killed by the drug dealers in this building. And I said, I'm running for office, and you're in my district, and I'm campaigning. And they were so taken back by that they all agreed to walk with me door to door. And I walked with these black housewives and mothers up and down the stairs of these housing projects with graffiti on the wall and urine on the floor. And I got the highest votes in black housing projects that any Republican had ever gotten in the history of New Rochelle, New York.
Wayne, that's
a
fantastic story.
A long time.
That's a fantastic story. That is
Well, I tell the Republican Party all the time, the reason you don't get black votes is you don't try. The reason you don't get Hispanic votes is you don't try. Here in Nevada, Michael, Democrats now control everything for the first time ever. Everything. And it's because we put up these horrible candidates who think running for office means that all you do is you raise money and you spend money and you take some TV ads and some radio ads. You never appear. You never wear out your shoe leather. You never go door to door. You never work hard. The guy who ran for governor and the guy who ran for Senate, Dean Heller, the two of them barely were seen the entire campaign season in Las Vegas and Clark County, even though it makes up 90% of the population of the state. They're both from upstate, meaning, you know, Lake Tahoe, Reno, Carson City. And they don't ever think it's important to come down here and campaign because they think they're going to lose here because Las Vegas is a Democratic city. So they don't even bother to try, and they both lost close. Mm. If they had worked hard, they both would have won. Well, I've never seen candidates so bad in my entire life.
Well, a case could be made that if Hillary followed that advice, she'd be president today based on
exactly.
the Electoral College.
It's all about wearing out the shoe leather. Exactly.
Yeah.
Wearing out the shoe leather and resonating with people. You know, the other thing I did when I ran in those days, forget about running for president as a libertarian, but when I ran for this county legislature thing, I took a map and I pinpointed every district and who lived there. This one is black and poor. This one is white middle class. This one is white blue collar. This one is Jewish and tends to be professional. And I said, if I'm the person living in that district, what's the issue or issues that matter to me? I'm 21 years old at this time. What are the issues that matter to me? And I figured out that in this district, they cared about clean streets and garbage delivery and homeowners issues and property taxes. In this, you know, district, it's about jobs. In this district, it's about welfare. And I created different flyers. Remember, there was no internet in those days. So I literally went to the printer, spent a ton of money, and created flyers that were different with different issues for every single neighborhood. So when I'm in this neighborhood, I hand out this flyer. When I'm in that neighborhood, I hand out the flyer that resonates with that group of people. And people were just so amazed that I at the age of 21, I was able to figure out what the average person cared about. And it's not the same thing in every district. And Republicans don't get it. They spend their lives talking about issues that matter to rich people, and they never ever, other than Donald Trump, ironically a billionaire, they never ever resonated with working class people. You know, and because I'm a son of a butcher and I think like my dad, the butcher, I will always resonate. My radio show, you know, there's nothing about it that's Columbia University. My radio show is like Fordham University. It's like aimed at working class people. Mm. It's aimed at people with a ninth grade reading level. That's how Donald Trump gives his speeches. So everybody can understand it and it resonates and it makes sense. This isn't about being an intellectual. I think many of the people on the radio are just way too intellectual, and that's great, okay? You proved you're smart, but the average person has no idea what you're talking about, and even if they did, it's not entertaining to them.
You say you're the son of a butcher, which indicates you come from a working-class, middle-class background and, you know, small business background, but you also say that your mother and father were the founders of the New York Conservative Party, which also, as I mentioned before, ain't chopped liver. That's a big deal. I would imagine a lot of this experience and wisdom that you developed about politics at the tender age of 21 came from your dad and your parents. Am I correct?
It did, and it also came from because of what they did. It came from the experience of from the age of three on. Three, I'm not joking. At the age of three, Barry Goldwater was running for president. And my dad had me in his arms, and I was handing out political literature at train stations and supermarkets for Barry Goldwater. That was when my political career began. You know, I was born in 61 and Goldwater ran in 64. So I literally was three when I got my first political experience. And by the time I was six, seven, and eight, my parents, whoever they were supporting at the time, for governor of New York, senator of New York, state senator, state assemblyman, mayor, I was running up and down apartment buildings, stairways and elevators, and I was, you know, starting at the 20th floor, and I put literature under every door, and then I go to the 19th floor and the 18th, and go down the building and hand out hundreds of pieces of literature, and anybody who caught me, I would tell them why I was supporting that candidate, and I was doing this at the age of 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and 10. I mean, I was schooled in politics at the local level, the campaign level, the get-out-the-vote level. So, you know, I was in politics my whole life, and yes, my dad and mom, despite him being a butcher and her being a homemaker, they answered an ad in the newspaper in 1962, the year after I was born. It said, if you think the Republican Party is a bunch of rhinos, see, they had that word even then, Republicans in name only, led by Javits and Rockefeller, the two biggest names in the New York State Republican Party in 1962, senator and governor at the time, but both very liberal. If you believe that the Republican Party is failing and you want to make it more conservative, come to the very first meeting of the founding of the Conservative Party of New York State. And the ad was created by J. Daniel Mahoney, who founded the party. My parents showed up. They were awarded Westchester County, and my dad was the chairman of Mount Vernon, New York, and later on Scarsdale, New York. And my parents were on the executive board of Westchester County and New York State. And so I was there, Michael, for the very beginnings of conservative politics. And I was there when James Buckley was elected United States Senator in liberal New York as a conservative candidate who beat the Democrat and the Republican, the first ever third-party U.S. Senator, I believe, in the history of New York State.
I remember that very well. Yeah, I remember that very well. I grew up in New York at that time. I remember Javits. I remember Rockefeller. I even have a photo of myself with Rockefeller as a very young teenager when he was running for president. Not for president, for governor. He ran, what, four times, beat people like Robert Morgenthau and Arthur Goldberg. And he ran against some pretty good people. I think he also beat Harriman when he first was elected. So he was a force in New York. And those were
a force.
Those were very, very.
And I'll give you one other name no one's ever going to remember. I'm not a big fan, obviously, of liberals and elitists. And while my dad was the insurgent butcher helping to run the Conservative Party and defeat the elitists and the liberals, there was a guy running and winning for U.S. Senate, and eventually he was beaten by James Buckley, my dad's candidate. And who was the guy who was the United States Senator, incumbent, Republican, beaten by Goodall? He's the father of the commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodall. It was Roger Goodall's dad that was the New York State Senator, beaten by James Buckley, who we felt was a rhino Republican, and knocked him out of office because he was too liberal. And so, you know, the world kind of comes around and goes around. It's all a circle, and nothing's ever new, you know?
So why did you drop out of politics after you ran for vice president on the Libertarian ticket? There was talk about you perhaps running for Senate in Las Vegas and other political ambitions. What made you suddenly go into radio and now radio and television?
I felt I could make a much bigger splash and a much bigger difference in people's lives. You know, if you run for office and you lose, first of all, you make no difference in anyone's life. None. If you win, then you can make a very big difference. But if you lose, nothing. But if you win, even, you know, if you're president, great. Donald Trump has huge say and sway in America. But the average senator, like the guy who just lost in Nevada, Dean Heller, I guarantee you, Michael, if you walked down the Vegas Strip and you asked 100 people who was Dean Heller at the time he was in office, now he's lost. Even at the time he was our United States senator, 99% of everyone would have no idea. They wouldn't even know the name. If you showed them a picture, they couldn't identify him in a lineup. And so I don't think senators have as much power as they think they have. Inside the Senate, they have power. They're important people. They're treated like gods. But on the streets of a city, nobody even knows who they are. But everybody, certainly every conservative, every working person knows who Rush Limbaugh is, knows who Michael Savage is, knows who Sean Hannity is, knows who Mark Levin is.
That's very interesting.
And if you're a conservative, you know, they have huge influence. Well, so I just decided.
You're making a good point. Sorry to interrupt you, but I want to get this point in. I've had this conversation with Sean Hannity over the years. Like, Sean, you know, because he and I are very friendly, and I've been following his career since he was a newbie in the business in Huntsville, Alabama. And I say, Sean, you know, there's all this talk about you being in politics. You could be a senator. You could be a congressman. You could even be president. And he says, why would I want to be a senator and be one of 100? Why would I want to be a congressman and be one of hundreds when I have such a unique platform as it is? And of course, there's always the opportunity, although broadcasting is not lucrative for most people, nor is politics. Those that make it big make a lot of money. So there's always that.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's no question. Sean Hannity has more say and sway and more name recognition and more brand, which has always been my thing. Michael, I was a brander. I always understood how you create a brand. Mm. And so I've always been in kind of this Donald Trump world or orbit because he was my hero and I considered mentor and all. I was a brander, and I'm very good at branding. And so Sean Hannity's brand is much bigger than all 100 senators combined, let alone any individual senator. He has that much power and that much name recognition. And in his case, like you said, not all broadcasters get rich. But when you're at the top, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity make more money than any politician can ever dream of. Certainly legally, you know, they may be stealing the politicians a lot more money than I know about. But legally, they're making $175,000 a year to be a senator or a governor, and Sean's making millions and millions of dollars, you know, the American dream. So to me, I'd rather be Rush Limbaugh than a United States senator any day of the week. Even though that was my dad's dream, I think I'm influencing more conservatives now and in the future, and I have the potential to influence millions if I can move up in the ranks in the next 5 years, do a far more important job than I could ever do as a single state's United States senator.
Are your parents still with us, or are they gone?
No, they both passed in 1992. They've been gone a long time. They died 28 days apart of cancer. Really sad year and a really tough story, which I don't even like getting into because I'm the tough guy and I never cry about anything. I can't even mention my mother and father's name without tears in my eyes. So I don't even like talking about it. But they did both die in 92 of cancer, and it was the toughest month of any human being's life to lose both your parents and realize you're an orphan. You know, thank God I was 29 years old. I wasn't a 9-year-old orphan. But when I realized the pain I felt at 29 losing both parents, I can't even imagine how someone grows up who's, you know, under the age of 18 and loses their parents. And that's the soft spot I've got in this world, you know.
Wow. I won't pursue that because I don't want you to start crying, but I definitely understand. And I imagine a day doesn't go by that you don't think about how proud they'd be of you seeing you continue down the track that they got to see the early stages of. One more question I want to ask you about the media. You've done very well now in radio, and your career is on the rise. And listening to the passion that you bring to this conversation, I can understand why. You've also now expanded into television, and Christopher Ruddy's operation, Newsmax TV, seems to be a real up-and-coming force in the media, in the cable news talk television arena. How has that experience been for you? And what's the difference between doing it on radio and doing it on television? And don't you, in some cases, simulcast? Are you doing it in both at the same time? Is that a difficult thing to do?
Yes. Well, you know, it's funny that I live in Vegas because I never understood in these Vegas shows how people go from number to number and in a matter of seconds change outfits. And I become really good at that. We do simulcast, Michael. It's 3 hours of radio on USA Radio. And the third hour, the camera turns on and my camera is in my home studio in Las Vegas. I built a home TV studio that's as beautiful as any TV set. I believe it's by far the best looking show on Newsmax TV. And I built it and I designed it. And we put the cameras in, and the camera turns on at precisely 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 Pacific, and all of a sudden I'm on national TV, and Newsmax, you know, when I started with them, reached 15 million homes total. That's not how many were watching. That's just how many homes it's in. Who knows, you know, the numbers that are watching, but we reached 15 million cable TV homes or satellite homes. Today we reached 70 million, and by the end of this year we'll be in 80 million. So I've been there for 2 years of meteoric growth, and we're not just a little upstart nipping at Fox's heels, although obviously Fox is the giant, the jolly green giant, and we're kind of the little guy trying to beat him, the underdog. But that's okay. I've been in the underdog role my whole life, and I've always thrived in it. So, you know, to go from 15 million homes to 70 million, and by the end of this year, 80 million, Chris Ruddy's doing something right. I am the big show on the network. I'm the primetime 8 o'clock position, and I know there's a tremendous audience just based on the fan mail. I get over 1,000 emails a week, which is amazing. I used to get under 100, and then I get 100, and then I get 200, and now I get over 1,000. And everyone says the same thing. I never heard of you in my life. I never saw you in my life. Never listened to your radio show in my life. By mistake, surfing the channel, found you one night, and I can't look away. Every day is highlighted by the time your show starts. I mean, I get 1,000 of these a week saying I've left Fox News forever. All I want to watch is your show because you tell truth that no one else tells. And finally, I went to Chris and company in the last month, and I said, we should change the name of the show. It shouldn't be the Wayne Allyroot Show anymore. It should be Wayne Allyroot, Raw and Unfiltered, because that says a lot about what I do that no one else does on TV. And I love Sean Hannity, and I love everyone else on Fox News. They're all great. Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham, all fabulous. But nobody talks for an hour with no script, no staff. You know, they've got 30 people working on their show. I got one, Wayne Root. And I have no one. The camera turns on, and I just rant and react for an hour to all the top news stories in America. I spend an hour before the radio show printing out the stories that I think are important, and I choose them. That's the important thing. You know, instead of NBC, ABC, CBS, I choose what I think the average working man or woman, the average middle-class man or woman, the average patriotic American wants to hear about. about that is not on the news tonight. And then I just spend 3 hours talking about it, and on TV I spend 1 hour, and I've rushed into my bedroom, because remember, my TV studio and radio studio in my house, and I literally put on a suit and a tie in like 3 minutes. I got a 5 minute break, and I'm back in time. I've never missed it. In 3 years, I've never missed it. And the TV camera goes on, and I'm in a gorgeous suit. 5 minutes ago, I was in my sweatpants.
Wayne, now, if it was really unedited and really raw, you would do the television show in your pajamas. You know,
there you go. Well, I do the radio show in my pajamas, so it's okay. But I definitely, you know, nobody else spends an hour with no script, no teleprompter, and no staff. And just what do I think the average person wants to talk about and hear about? And let's discuss it. And that's what I do. I let it rip, and I take a ton of calls on national TV, which is also very, very unusual. Obviously, no one on Fox takes calls, but you could call Wayne Root and see your name and your face literally up on the screen. John from New Rochelle, New York. You know, your identification of where you're from is up on that screen, and you're talking to me, and you could watch it while it's going on. I think that, in its essence, Michael, is what politics and talk radio and talk TV are really about.
All right. In conclusion, what would you do? And maybe you never think about this, and you could say it could never happen, and I would accept that as your answer. But in the recesses of your mind, do you ever worry that being human and being now a politician, that Trump could let you down? What would you do if suddenly you started to see, as time goes by, a year goes by, 2 years go by, 3 years, he's reelected, perhaps he's now in his second term, things change. Suddenly you don't like what you see. Suddenly you are skeptical about some of his decisions. What would you do? How would you handle it? And how would you go about handling the expectations of your big audience that you've developed?
Well, I do doubt it's going to happen. I'm always unhappy because it's never quite where I want it to go right now. I love Trump. I think he's the best we've got. I think he's the only alternative we got. I think he's like the police, the thin blue line. I think he's the only thing preventing America from not being America anymore and losing the things I believe in, capitalism and opportunity and mobility and low taxes and low regulations and a great economy and a country for the great middle class and the police and the military and the small business. Those are all the things I believe in. Judeo-Christian values. I believe in all those things, and I believe that country and those things were being lost, and if Hillary had won, they'd be gone forever. Trump won, they've been saved for the moment. So I love the guy, and I celebrate the guy, and I champion the guy, and I think he's great, and he's the best we got, and he's the only thing we got, and he's the thin blue line. But having said that, it comes back to one of the very first questions you asked in this interview about me running for the Libertarian presidential nomination in 2007 and winning the vice presidential nomination in 2008. People ask me why I decided out of the blue to run for national political office and how did I win the VP nomination. I started out as a huge fan of George W. Bush as president. And I fought for him, helped get him elected, fought for him again, helped get him reelected, was thrilled he was president, and somewhere in the middle of that second term grew incredibly negative about George W. Bush, realized he was doing and saying things that would destroy the Republican Party long term, sour people on the Republican Party, and result, in my opinion at the time, my gut said, the loss of the House and the Senate and the loss of the next election in 2008, and we'd get a Barack Obama, and sure enough, I was right about everything. Bush was so bad in the end that he caused everyone to sour on the GOP, and he led to Barack Obama. If Bush isn't an idiot and doesn't add more debt, until Obama came along, of course, more debt to the United States than any president before him, and spend like a drunken sailor and never veto a single spending bill, if Bush doesn't do that, we don't get Barack Obama. So I soured on Bush and for the first time in my life left the Republican Party, ran for the Libertarian presidential nomination, missed it by a matter of just a handful of votes, and wound up the vice presidential nominee with Bob Barr as my running mate in 2008. So, you know, when you say if you sour on Trump, would you still defend him? I loved Bush, defended him day and night, but as soon as I realized he wasn't who I thought he was and he was an elitist and a deep stater and a D.C. swamp guy, and all he ever did was veto, was accept spending instead of veto it, I soured on the GOP, left my own party, thought they'd abandon me, and ran for another party and put my money where my mouth was and won the VP nomination and wound up on Neil Cavuto the next morning and became a national political figure. So, you know, if Trump lets me down, trust me, as much as I love him, my boot is on his neck, and so is every other one of the 63 million Trump voters. If he doesn't continue to be the Trump we elected, we'll sour on him, and we'll support the next guy, and we'll hope that things change. What else can we do?
And there you have it, a conversation with rising conservative talk media star Wayne Allen Root of USA Radio Network and Newsmax TV. To learn more about Wayne Allen Root, visit rootforamerica.com. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. The Michael Harrison Interview. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a presentation of Podcast One, produced in association with Talkers Magazine and Good Phone Communications. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved.